Hey again, guys. How's it going? Today, I want to start things off a little bit different. I want to tell the story of two kings, one older and one younger, a grandfather and a grandson. And so if you want to turn to 2 Chronicles 33 with me, I'd love for you to do that. It's not a super popular book. It might be unfamiliar to you. So I'd love for you to go check that out in your Bible app or search it in Google if you want to get a little bit deeper in a more obscure book. But of course, we'll put some stuff up on the screen. So if you can't find it, you don't want to, don't worry, we got you covered. But the Old Testament tells the story of the early history of God interacting with humanity, and it does so through the lens primarily of the nation of Israel, the rise and fall of God's people through that country. And these two kings, they exist towards the end of their time as the kingdom is kind of deteriorating, and things begin changing quite a bit. And so Chronicles, Kings, they tell you about each king that ruled throughout that area throughout that long period of time from about 1,000 BC to around 500 or so AD. And it tells you brief summaries of each king. And so towards the end, you get this king. His name is Manasseh. This is how it describes that older king, Manasseh. Manasseh was 12 years old, pretty young, when he became king. And he reigned in Jerusalem 55 years. That's the longest of any king that was on the throne there in Jerusalem. And he did what was evil in the Lord's sight, following detestable practices. Now, if you're reading in different translations and things, it'll go on to describe them in varying details of what that means. But essentially, he encouraged people to worship people that worship gods that weren't our God, that weren't Yahweh, that weren't what would eventually be revealed as Jesus. He worshipped other gods, and specifically a lot of fertility gods. And so he, lack of a better term, keeping this appropriate, he helped erect statues that would go along with that and encourage practices that would engage in those sorts of things as well. But beyond that, it also says that he was the catalyst for the shedding of a lot of innocent blood, including he was involved in some child sacrifices. And so obviously, this is a guy that we would not be cool with. This is a guy that is not a role model. This is not somebody we should look up to. This guy was one of the worst people in human history. And of course, God is enraged by him as well. And so he empowers this war nation of Assyria to come down and capture Manasseh. And then his life begins to change. So you go on a little bit longer in 2 Chronicles, and this is what you get. But while in deep distress, Manasseh sought the Lord his God and sincerely humbled himself before the God of his ancestors. And when he prayed, the Lord listened to him and was moved by his request. So the Lord brought Manasseh back to Jerusalem and to his kingdom. So after this, he tries to make a lot of reforms. He tries to change a lot of things. It was a little bit of too little, too late, but he began the process in his lifetime. Now, his grandson's story, who took over not long after him, it starts very differently. If you flip to the next chapter, it begins this way. Josiah was 8 years old when he became king, even younger. And he reigned in Jerusalem 31 years. But in contrast to his grandfather, he did what was pleasing in the Lord's sight and followed the example of his ancestor David. He did not turn away from doing what was right. And during the 8th year of his reign, while he was still young, 16 that would be, Josiah began to seek the God of his ancestors, David. So he's 8, extremely young, but then eventually by the time he's 20 years old, he's making full-scale humanitarian, social, and cultural changes. And if you go on to study him more and more and more, because of him, it's because of him and his legacy that God's people survive even as the rest of the nation deteriorates around them. See, Josiah's legacy cannot be underestimated because it eventually has a global impact as it leads directly to Jesus. I had a professor once ask about Manasseh and his repentance and his humility. Even though it was late in life, how much of an impact did it have on his grandson? Was it because of his example that Josiah was able to humble himself and put his heart in the right place as he began to reign so early in his own life? See, if you study the Bible, you'll quickly recognize that it's overly obsessed with the ways that generations, connect, the way they influence each other, and all the interconnectivity that goes between them, their impact on each other. So this morning's kind of a weird Sunday, right? We're sandwiched in between a couple big things. Last week, we had all of our leadership team up here, and they shared a vision about the past and the present and the future. And so we had Matt up here, and Victoria, and Jacob, and Brad, and the other Brad, and Nick, and probably another Brad on top of that, and Chris. We had them all up here sharing a little bit about what they thought was ahead for Discovery in the future. It was a really great message, and so I'd encourage you to go onto our fancy website if you missed it and check it out and hear straight from their voices, straight from their hearts, what they think about this incredible community that we get to be a part of. And next week, we're excited to launch a series called Families in Training. You've got the cards in your program. It's going to be an incredible series and an opportunity for us to empower families and encourage them to have purpose and drive and meaning and direction in their grace-filled lives as they try to lead those families. And with that series, we recognize that, you know, that's going to miss maybe a couple people that are a little bit younger, including me, because I have a wife. It's my family, but I don't have any kids yet, though it's never too early to start preparing for the next stage of life, right? And so when Matt asked me to come up here and speak in this kind of in-between time, I thought, man, what a better thing to talk about than some in-between people. And so something I'm uniquely capable to address, because this message gets to be about me. It gets to be about my friends, everyone that I grew up with. And so we're going to call this message today Confessions of a Millennial. All right? You know, it's here where we're coming from and learn more about us. Chances are over the last 10 or so years, you've grown sick of this term millennial because it's everywhere. Right, as young people my age started to enter college and then exit that place into your places of work, into your internship programs, and they moved into your neighborhood and into this city, especially this city, Pittsburgh is well known as being one of the top-rated places for millennials to move because of affordability of housing, but also the emerging industries that are going in here. See, millennials have flooded into those once abandoned areas of our city like Lawrenceville, Millvale, and I think I said that totally wrong. Sorry, guys. Millville? Well, I don't know how you say that. Millvale and into the north side and places like that. Wherever the housing is somewhat affordable and the murals are rampant and there's free Wi-Fi in the coffee shops so that we can like work on our side hustles and things like that. We're moving out of our parents' basements and into lofts in your city and in your neighborhood with 10 of our closest friends so we can afford it. So it's changing. Things are changing. It's exciting. Millennials are right now between the ages of 20 and 34, depending on who you ask. That's such a broad range, but I kind of like to redefine them as people that don't really remember a time before the internet, but they're old enough to remember that magical screech of AOL, right? It's a beautiful sound, and we loved it, and we nostalgically use it way too much. I just had a birthday. No applause. I'm surprised. Thanks. Thanks so much. I did just have a birthday. Appreciate it. Yes. With the fast and reckless way I live, it's incredible that I made it another year, right? So I just had a birthday and realized, man, we're getting old. Like, I didn't realize how old we were as a group. We still feel like we're like 16 years old. But man, as we have been talking about it for years, millennials coming into their own, we've thought, man, they are the future business leaders, the future politicians, the future pastors, but it's not like that anymore. We are the current business leaders, the current politicians, the current pastors. We are filling out all of these leadership roles in our country, in our city at a rapid rate. Did you know statistically that millennials are one half of the workforce? That approximately 25% of Americans are millennials. That's about 80 million millennials. It's the largest single generational group in this country. This year, we'll have a purchasing power that will exceed boomers at $1.3 trillion. We're going to have more money than our parents, finally. Chances are, if you're hearing this, though, you are probably not technically a millennial. And if you are, you're an older, wiser one. You're not a typical millennial. Many of the people here at Discovery that call this place home, we typically fit into the Gen Xers, the boomers, the silent generation, and there's a few reasons for that. Two of them that I really want to point out that I think are really big reasons are, one, most people come back to church when they're settling down with a family. And my generation is the most transient and unsettled generation of all time because we're in our 20s right now. And did you know that our generation, the average time that we exist in a job, that we have a job, we hold a job, I guess, is 11 months. That's super short, right? 11 months is the average time we have a job. Secondly, the fastest growing religion in America, you've probably heard this before, is no religion at all. That doesn't mean atheism. That's not what it's saying. It's just saying we're disassociated. People are disassociated. There's 25% of Americans that would claim that designation. If they were asked what religion that they adhere to, they would write down none. We just don't have one. Millennials, 40% of us designate that. And that doesn't mean that we don't pray or that we don't have any spiritual practices. Actually, on the contrary, that stuff has stayed stable, but we're less and less likely to nail down who we worship and where we worship. But as young adults move in and out of Pittsburgh and come into their own as leaders in our community, we want to disrupt those reasons and the many more that they might provide by providing a place and a space where young adults, no matter their stage of life, where they feel like they belong. And I think we can do that if we get to know millennials just a little bit better. Now, we can't call this a confessions of a millennial without a few confessions. And so I just want to air some things out, get some things off my chest that are true about me that you've all been wondering. I know you have. So here we go. Just a few things. One, I lived in my parents' basement during the summer and fall of 2012, okay? So there you go, you know. Secondly, I did stay on my parents' healthcare insurance until I was kicked off. It's there, you gotta take it, you gotta grab a hold of it, all right? Chill out. Three, my Instagram account is active, but it specifically revolves itself around food, okay? I want you to know what I've been eating, but specifically though, it's mostly around what my wife is eating. Hashtag Sam eats, go follow it. It's like a viral phenomenon. So go check that out. Fourthly, I do have a stack of tie-dye ribbons from cross-country races that I admittedly mostly walked. So those exist. I have them somewhere. All right. Five, this one, just very recently, I bought a house mostly for my dog, okay? So we put it out there. I saw an article that millennials are doing that more and more right after I did it. So whoops, I'm guilty. Who cares? It happened. Six, I spent an unspeakable amount of money at a boutique coffee shop last year. I saw the numbers. I am not going to tell you what they were, but I'll just tell you, you should be appalled. You would be embarrassed to know me. And then lastly, I admit that I'm a recovering narcissist, and that's why I wanted to write a message about myself. So there you go. So yes, those are my qualifications. That's my millennialness. That's the authority I have to speak on this topic. There are a lot of things out there written about who we are and what we're like. The classic stereotype is, of course, this, that we're lazy, entitled narcissists who still live with our parents. Well, that's exactly what Time Magazine said on their cover issue in 2013. Calling us the me generation, right? And so there are some strong opinions about how messed up my young generation is. Let's check out what others have had to say about us through the years. Here's one. They have trouble making decisions. They would rather hike in the Himalayas than climb a corporate ladder. They crave entertainment, but their attention span is short. And they postpone marriage because they dread divorce. You know, this shouldn't be in there. This was actually said about Gen Xers in 1990. My bad. All right, I'm sure this one will definitely be about millennials. The now generation has become the me generation. Oh, again, New York Times, 1976. This was about boomers. My apologies, guys. We'll get one right here. This one's definitely got to be about millennials. There they are, those preening narcissists who have to document every banal moment with their cutting-edge communications technologies. Clearly, they're talking about like Facebook and Instagram and stuff. Sorry, this is a Newsweek article from 1985 about camcorders. My bad. All right, one more. We'll try. We'll make it work. Okay. I see no hope for the future of our people if they are dependent on the frivolous youth of today. A lot of people would probably say that. But this was actually said by Hesiod in the 8th century, the father of modern economics. So there you go. I should have said 8th century BC like that. Not just 8th century, this is forever ago. Anyway, here's the thing. Many of the things about millennials, many of the problems we have, they're not millennial issues. They're young people issues. Here's the problem with every generation. We love to fall into the trap of what C.S. Lewis calls chronological snobbery. That is that our generation or our time period, whichever one you're a part of, the values, the ways of growing up, the taste, the ways of living, it's better than any of the other ones, and all the other ones are doomed. So we have a hard time seeing outside of what we've experienced to see what's authentically good in another generation and what's objectively destructive about our own. New is not always better, but sometimes it is. And the good old days, tainted by nostalgia and the imperfection of our memories, may have had a lot of beautiful things, but they were not perfect or necessarily better either. See, there's a tendency for older generations to default to pessimism about younger generations throughout all of history. And what would it mean if in our millennial-saturated city, if Discovery Christian Church became a unique community full of optimism and excitement about the next generation? What a refreshing change of pace. Matt challenged us to do this not long ago, a few weeks ago, when he challenged us to look at people that are further behind us, people that are younger than us, and start sentences with a couple simple words, I see in you blank. Of course, it goes both ways as older and younger generations learn to humbly respect each other. There are things that you can teach millennials, but there are also things that millennials can teach you. James, Jesus' brother, he gives us this timeless, powerful advice that goes like this. Understand this, my dear brothers and sisters. You must always be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry, judgmental, indignant. As one pastor says about this passage, if you don't understand someone, where they're coming from, why they do what they do, who has the problem? You do. You don't understand. Understanding takes patience, time, listening, and most of all, humility. See, our ability as individuals and as a church to love millennials depends on our ability to truly understand the real them, not the cliches. And so I want to spend the rest of our time looking at a few general ideas that I think help explain some of the best and the worst things about our generation. And I hope in these things, you will be able to see where this younger generation is coming from, both our strengths and our weaknesses. Now, admittedly, these are generalizations, okay? So, like, this might not be true of you. This might not be exactly true of everybody you know. But for the most part, this is statistically true for most of our generation, most people in that age range from 20 to about 34. Millennials are, one, hungry for authentic relationships, but lost in shallow connections. See, over and over and over again, we see this in movies and TV shows that target my age range. Man, we love to have real relationships, authentic friendships, these incredible deep things that bind us together, and yet we have a really hard time actually building those from the ground up. See, here's kind of what happened to us. Throughout our first 26-ish years of life, we primarily related to people in our own grades, at our own age level, at our own level in general. We had these peers, these almost assigned friendships that surrounded us, and that all culminates in this thing called college, which is just another word for an overly priced small city that it's full of young adults, right? And so we had people down next door, down our floor that we interact with all the time that are just like us, and we grew to depend on that kind of provision for relationships. And then suddenly, we're seemingly thrust out of our comfort zones, thrust out of our securities, thrust out of our families into completely new places where we oftentimes struggle to find people like us and relate to people that aren't like us. So we're thrown out into your neighborhood, into your place of work, and suddenly we're constantly around people with a lot more experience and skills and opinions, and it can be difficult to feel connected. As we seek to prove ourselves and build our lives, we find ourselves in this new multi-generational experience away from the regular connection from our supportive families, potentially, or at least our long-term friends. See, one thing I hear from young adults over and over again, and like even from myself, and this sounds so silly and simple, but it's a real problem. It's completely true. We have a hard time finding and making real friends. And yet that's what we really want. That's why we gather in certain places and towns like coffee shops and bars that we can't really afford because because we want to connect with people. And so what do we do when that doesn't work out? We turn to that thing that we know, that thing that we grew up with, because we grew up with the internet as a supplement to our personal relationships. But then as we become lonelier and lonelier, it easily becomes our primary source for connection and affirmation and expression. See, every heart or thumbs up gives us a shot of dopamine that's satisfying for a second, but just leaves us eventually empty and depressed. Social sciences say all the time that the things we're looking for in terms of relationship, digital media can never give us. It's like feeding your hunger with candy. You just feel empty inside after you've eaten a whole bunch. What makes it worse is that our interconnectivity has shown us the best of people's lives and our hyper-successful peers. And we can compare our real life to their highlight reels. Some articles are calling this the new OCD, obsessive comparison disorder. And as one young adult interviewed in a massive study, he said it this way: "We are a generation that is ruthlessly comparing ourselves with those around us and our role models all at the same time. And if we are not doing something exceptional or don't feel important and fulfilled for what we are doing, we have a hard time." And yet we're addicted to this self-abuse, right? I mean, as a culture, we're kind of addicted already, right? Like, how many times have you left for work without your phone? What do you do then? You get a police escort and you get back there as soon as possible, right? How many of you check your phone when you don't have a text message or a call that's coming through? You just habitually do it. Or you're at a dinner and conversation kind of gets awkward or there's a dead silence. What do we immediately do? Pick up the phone that's sitting right in front of us. We're addicted to it. And when we're bored, instead of going outside with God or going on an adventure with a friend, we oftentimes pacify ourselves or distract ourselves with Season 5 or Candy Crush or Instagram, and we get lost in this empty, fictionalized reality for hours when we really just want deep friendships. And this is a cultural problem. This is a marriage problem. This is a parenting problem. But for unestablished, transient, inexperienced, connected young adults, this is a crisis. See, we really need is established people in our cities, our neighborhoods, and our places of work, our churches, to make space for us in our lives and to teach us the art of connection. I know so many of you have done that already for me and my wife, and that's what gives me the strength to be able to stand up here and talk about this stuff and feel empowered. But there are so many young adults around you that you just think are defensive or arrogant or standoffish, when what they really are is insecure and socially awkward. We need some opportunities to develop real relationships with you over long periods of time. As one of my friends says, quality time is a side effect of quantity of time. You can't schedule quality time. It shows up when you give an opportunity for it to thrive. Just the other day, I heard of this incredible couple. They're from and planted a church in South Africa. And then they came over to California. They planted a church there, and now they just turned 60 and 56, respectively, and they felt like God was telling them, we need to plant another church. And they're still down in Costa Mesa, California, and they noticed that there's a lot of young adults in our area, but there's not a lot of churches connecting with them, even though there's plenty of great churches around us. And so what do we need to do differently to love young adults? And so they set their dining room table, and they planned a meal, and they invited 5 young adults over, and they ate all of their steak, drank all of their scotch, and at the end of the night convinced them that this is what they needed to start doing. And in the course of 2 weeks, they went from 5 young adults to 55 young adults filling out their dining room and into their backyard and gathering around their table. They said the pulpit is not the pulpit of millennials. The table is. That's the opportunity to connect. See, millennials might reject you at first or keep their distance, but I promise what they really want, what they actually need, and what we're not getting enough of is more relationships with both our peers and other generations. What if we became a church with a reputation for having open seats at our dining room tables, well-worn divots in our couches, and a seemingly unending supply of logs for our fire pits? The church is called to be a place of hospitality for everyone, and that might mean making an invitation to people over and over and over and over and over again, and being the first person to step out and do that. Because, by the way, even when you get rejected over and over and over and over and over again, that's what Jesus does too. Secondly, millennials have unlimited information but limited practice. Millennials are the most educated generation in the whole history of humanity. Furthermore, we access and utilize the internet like it's a second, another limb. I was going to say a second limb, but we have more than that. Like it's a limb that they have. We're smart, we're educated, and we hope you know and see that and listen to us at least sometimes. But here's the thing. We can know just about everything about anything, except for what we really need and really want to know about life. Many of us have this misconception that millennials just want fame and money and to be CEO all by the time they're 27. But did you know that Pew Research actually studied this, and this is what they found? They were asked to kind of rank their priorities in life, and this is what they showed. The number one priority for millennials was being a good parent. And then having a successful marriage, then helping others, then owning a home, then having a very religious life, and then towards the bottom, it's about free time, high-paying career, and being famous was the least of all their concerns. See, these aren't things you can Google. These are things you have to see in others, and that was in 2010, by the way. That was back when we were in high school and college. What we really want are those deep values, those things that Jesus, Christianity, the church calls followers to invest in. Family, serving others, making a difference. We don't want religion, but what we do want is to look more like Jesus. Matt said this recently as we were talking in the office. It seems like for our generation, what we want is first to become like Jesus, then belong to a Jesus community, and then finally believe in that Jesus, in Jesus. So what if we became a place where young adults knew they could come to find those models and mentors to achieve those things they really want? Because we want to see how you parent. Don't hide it from us. We want to see how your marriage works, so don't hide your fight from us. We want to see how you work, so don't hide the tension of balance and coping with failure from us. Lastly, millennials accept everyone except for themselves. See, we're the most diverse, educated, and interconnected generation, and because of that, we know a lot, but part of what we know is just how much we don't actually know. We don't understand every culture in the world, and so we try to create a culture of understanding. The weirdest thing is we're so generous with other people, though, but constantly, statistically, as a generational whole, we are very hard on ourselves. As one writer indicates, millennials are growing up at a tough time. They were sheltered in many ways with a lot of high expectations for what they should achieve. Individual failure is difficult to accept when confronted with a sense that you're an important person and you're expected to achieve, even though in the most instances, it's not their fault. The economy collapsed just as many of them were getting out of college and coming of age, and that does lead to a greater sense of stress. See, wages stagnated while expectations grew, job opportunities shrank. And we were told if we put our minds to it, we could be anything we wanted, and we went to college and we came out on the other side with an average of $33,000 in debt. Many of us hardly could find a job. If we did, it was in the entry-level areas of our work, and a lot of times it wasn't even in the thing that we studied. Not to mention that 80% of the most defining moments and decisions of your life are made in your 20s. Marriage, career, kids, which is right where millennials are. Responsibilities change rapidly as we're trying to get a hold of the competence to address them. Look at some of the headlines over the last few years about millennials. We're the most stressed out generation, young adults, Time Magazine. The problem with millennials, they're way too hard on themselves. That's Harvard Business Review. Why your late 20s are the worst time of your life. They can't even, which is a perfect example of like a marketing executive trying to like be cool, right? But they can't even. Why millennials are the anxious generation. See, we're known as the most narcissistic generation, but statistically, it actually shows we're the most unconfident, self-conscious, and anxious generation in recent history. You might be looking at that and thinking, and what we oftentimes want to say to these people is, grow up. And young adults are trying to say back, that's what we're trying to do.
So those of us who follow Jesus, we're people of grace. And we as millennials need to constantly remind ourselves of unlimited grace and its availability. And we know we can always get that from Jesus, but how much more powerful would it be if we could get it from people consistently who are meant to represent him in our lives? Here's a long-standing truth. Paul says it in some ways. Jesus illustrates it over and over again, and social sciences have proved it to be true. We impress others with our strength, but we connect with our weaknesses. So we want mentors, not managers. We want coaches, not critics. And I promise, if you make a shift in the way that you care about people, you're honest and vulnerable and open, you will see more productivity, better relationships, and increasing morale wherever you connect with young adults, whether they're your kids, your employees, your coworkers. Be honest with them. Be open with them. Can I just say, if you're a boomer, silent generation, Gen Xer, your words are heavy. We act like we don't care what you have to say, but really we're hanging on every single word. We're the generation that made nerds awesome. So don't worry about trying to be cool. Like, we have a whole arenas packed out around the world full of people playing video games competitively. You don't have to be cool. Stop trying to speak our language or act like us. You don't have to dress like millennials or talk like millennials. You just need to be you, because that's what we want. One cultural commentator at a recent marketing conference, he said this: young people, they don't need you to talk to them in their language. They just want to be treated like intelligent people who are worthy of respect. So often the stereotypes are dismissive, and while we get a lot wrong, so do other generations. We both have to learn to commit ourselves to a deep sense of humility. And if we want to be a community that loves, serves, and connects with that generation that's coming to their own right now, the future and current leaders of our city and our nation, we honestly just need to make generous space for them in our lives and in our church, to seek to hear them out, respect them, give them grace, relationship, and just a couple shots at trying to figure things out. I know there's a lot of people here that do invest in that generation, that love millennials, that involve themselves in those lives informally around fire pits or at local restaurants. But one of the things that we're really excited to be a part of, some people that are here at Discovery, is this conference called Merge. Merge is a one-day young adult conference in which we get to engage young adults, gather them together into one room, and empower them to go out and make a difference in the world. And I'm pretty involved in it. There's a few other people that are involved in it. This isn't a Discovery thing. This is other churches, other young adults, other organizations knowing that something needs to happen to be able to empower us, to gather us together, to build friendships, and to get a better sense of purpose and encouragement. And so we're going to gather a bunch of young adults coming up here soon. If you're young, man, we'd love for you to come. If you're not young, or you wouldn't classify yourself that way, or you don't want to be involved in that, we would love to partner with you in other ways. Come find me later. I would love to tell you about opportunities to do that. But this year, we're going to gather with some awesome speakers, and they're going to share some really incredible messages that are connected around this one question: if not now, when? Because we think if young adults can get a few things right now, we will be able to get a lot right in the future. And so we're going to help people learn how to be a leader before they're given the position. We're going to encourage them to develop joy in their life before they have it all. And lastly, we're going to ask them to learn to be humble before they're humbled. See, I started today with a look at Manasseh and Josiah, an older leader who repented later in life, resulting in an impact in another generation. And a young leader who began from a place of humility, creating an incredible legacy and lineage that made a way for Jesus. And when I hear that story, this is what I'm reminded of. You're never too old to humble yourself and make a lasting impact. And you're never too young to humble yourself and make a lasting impact. Humility is intergenerational glue. And we need that humility to build relationships between us for the sake of our city, for the sake of a world. And just like Manasseh and Josiah, there are communities, there are generations, there are countries depending on us humbling ourselves and entering into grace-filled relationships with each other. I just want to close out with some of Peter's words to older generations and younger generations. Peter, who learned it firsthand from Jesus, this is what he said: "Now a word to you who are older in the churches. I too am older, and a witness to the suffering of Christ, then I too will share in his glory when he is revealed to the whole world. As a fellow older person, I appeal to you, care for the flock that God has entrusted to you. Watch over it willingly, not grudgingly, not for what you will get out of it, but because you are eager to serve God. Don't lord it over them. Don't lord it over the people assigned to your care, but lead them by your own good example, model, mentor, coach. And when the great shepherd appears, you will receive a crown of never-ending glory and honor. What does he say to young adults, to millennials? In the same way, you who are younger must accept the authority of the elders. Man, that is humility, right? And all of you, dress yourselves in humility as you relate to one another, for God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And that's the grace that we could all use a little bit more of. And by the way, humility starts with you, not somebody else. It starts with you. Let's all grasp a hold of that humility and let God's grace fill our lives up. Let's pray. God, we just ask for you to teach us what it means to be humble. Teach us how to love and care for people that surround us. Teach us how to be connected to people in our cities and spread your influence throughout it. God, as we see young adults come into this city and come into our area, may we be a place that accepts them and welcomes them, to mentor, to coach, to care. May we be a place that opens up spaces in our homes. Give us the margin in our lives somehow that we can be able to intentionally invest in upcoming generations and leaders. God, I'm humbled standing up here talking about this when I know people who are older than me who are doing this for young adults, and it's so beautiful and good to see. And so I just pray that you'll continue to empower them to do that, help them to see the beauty in what they're doing, but help more of us to be able to connect, make space and room in our lives to build humble relationships with people of all generations. Love you, God. It's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.